Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, and in this episode, we catch up with our Asia-Pacific editor for our monthly roundup of all the news from the region. And in an interview with the new Managing Director of the National Security and Defence Business at Leidos UK, we discuss the company's new strategy in the defence, intelligence and national security markets. But first, it's time for the headlines. And we start in Europe, where two types of UGV from Estonia-based Milrem Robotics can now be equipped with a multi-canister loitering munition launcher from Israeli firm UVision, in what the two companies described as a new step in man-machine battlefield collaboration. This sees UVision's Hero 120 and Hero 400EC loitering munitions mounted in launchers on Milrem's Themis UGV and Type X robotic combat vehicle. This blend of technology could give forces a combination of advanced ISR and long-range heavy firepower. In Bulgaria, proposals from General Dynamics European Land Systems and Patria have been down-selected for the second phase of an 8x8 IFV procurement program. The Bulgarian MOD selected the Patria AMV XP and the GD-ELS MOAG Piranha 5, preferring them to the Nexta VBCI and Artec Boxer. Shepherd Defence Insight notes that the Bulgarian Army has given high priority to procuring 90 new 8x8 IFVs to equip four battalion-sized battle groups for an estimated cost of $540 million. Moving to the Middle East, Egypt is close to receiving an array of US-supplied equipment for port security and maritime surveillance after the State Department approved an FMS package worth an estimated $417 million. The country, which links North Africa to the Middle East, requires a real-time maritime situational awareness capability to defend its EEZ, natural resources, and ports, according to the US Defense and Security Cooperation Agency. Equipment to be provided under the proposed deal includes an intelligent fiber intrusion detection system, 12 VTOL UAVs with 6 ground stations, 14 mobile maritime surveillance vehicles, and 3 ISR aerostats. In the naval domain, as the UK prepares to deploy its regenerated carrier strike capability in 2021, the performance of HMS Queen Elizabeth and its integrated RN, RAF and US Marine Corps air wing in Exercise Joint Warrior will be closely watched by defence observers. The Minister for the Armed Forces, James Heapy, said on 28th of September that, quote, allies and adversaries alike will not fail to take note of the powerful new contribution the UK's carrier strike group offers NATO, end quote. Comments from naval analysts in Washington have spoken positively about this nascent UK strike capability, although cautioned that the embarkation of US Marine Corps F-35Bs could be a rare instance, given the existing operational demands being placed on that service. It's time now to bring the show to the rest of the crew, and that means welcoming Air Editor Tim Martin and News Editor Ben Vogel. Hi, both.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, Rich.
So, Richard, yeah, I'm quite interested in this naval story that you just mentioned, and I'm wondering, really, what kind of benefits will embarking Marine Corps F-35Bs bring to the US?
Well, it shows a degree of interoperability with a key NATO ally. That's always a good thing to be able to do. It's good practice for the Marine Corps to operate on big deck carriers. Of course, they operate from not smaller, but comparatively smaller LHDs like the America class. So it's a chance to, as I say, to operate on big deck carriers, which isn't something they always get a chance to do. As I sort of alluded to, that how regular this occurrence might be is up in the air. I know the UK is probably quite keen for the Marine Corps to operate from its carriers as often as possible until its own forces, the UK's own forces of F-35Bs is bulked up a bit. But this might be a bit more of a rare instance than we might have been led to believe.
And
don't forget on the force structure of the US Marine Corps. You know, recently they moved out with a kind of repositioning of what they want to do. So, you know, there's going to be potentially F-35 cuts for the Marine Corps. So just on that, you know, it's quite interesting, you know, how many of these will eventually be procured away from the operational side, let's say.
Once upon a time, about 15 years or so ago, wasn't it, the DOD was talking about the future UK carrier being interoperable with USN assets, sort of folding into the USN battle groups, carrier groups, rather. So how realistic is this ambition now, would you say?
I don't really think the US Navy necessarily needs this carrier to augment its own forces. It obviously operates a fleet of 10 operational or 11 operational Nimitz class at the present moment. So, yeah, I think the aspiration that the UK, the intent that the UK was able to portray to the public was that this carrier would be able to interoperate and link in with the US Navy's carrier strike groups as though that it was a capability that was desired by the US Navy to augment its own forces. And that's not the case because the US Navy is perfectly capable of doing what it needs to do, how it wants to do it. I think what this proves and what the US Navy is pleased to see is this, a NATO ally able to project power within its own region, within the Atlantic, within the Mediterranean, and to some extent, to a greater extent, into the Middle East. It can obviously, the Queen Elizabeth class can probably be docked and sort of maintained at Duqm in Oman. But further afield into Asia-Pacific region, I know Queen Elizabeth will be deploying there next year. I don't think that's going to be a regular deployment. That said, the integrated review is just around the corner, we think. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of direction policymakers want to point defence in, whether it's towards the Asia-Pacific region, yet to say. One more interesting point about the idea that UK carrier could fit in with US Navy carrier strike groups. So the US Navy, the Secretary of Defense, Esper, in the last couple of days announced that the plan for a 2045 structure for the US Navy would see 8 to 11 Nimitz or Ford-sized aircraft carriers and half a dozen what he described as light aircraft carriers, similar in size, let's say, to the America class or something like that. So it's interesting that they are looking at what they term light carriers, most of us would term super carriers. But anyway, they're looking at smaller size carriers and how that would sort of fit into their own operational needs in the Asia-Pacific region.
But do you think the Royal Navy has all its ducks in a row in terms of the making sure that the two aircraft carriers have the appropriate supporting surface assets and fleet train?
Just about. I think they can just about form a carrier strike group and maintain a few standing operations beyond that, let's say in the South Atlantic, in the Caribbean, with OPVs and some RFA assets. But I think its combat surface fleet is going to be more or less solely dedicated to protecting the carrier strike group when it's actually built up. So that's the Type 26s, the 45s, the Type 31s, when they eventually come into service, I can't see them really being used in the carrier strike group. They're more of an ocean-going patrolling corvette. So the Navy's hard-pressed to meet the demands that the strike group is placing upon the service. And I suppose time will tell as to how much pressure it can hold. We'll see.
Yeah, and if I add on the air side, I mean, there is still a big question of how many squadrons are going to be deployed from aircraft carriers.
Yep.
You know, what you know, so that's still a big question mark that'll have to be eventually sorted out, probably sooner rather than later.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ben, let's move over to the land side. We've got a story from the US this week on a new capability that falls into one of the US Army's 2019 modernization strategy priorities. What's the platform?
Indeed, yes. I mean, our colleague Flavia Camargos Pereira reports on a very big contract award to General Dynamics for interim short-range air defence, or IM-SHORAD, on Stryker vehicles. Now, IM-SHORAD is planned as a new mobile and manoeuvrable air defence system that can operate in direct support of the Stryker Brigade combat teams in the US Army. And our colleagues at Shepherd Defence Insights say the multi-purpose IM-SHORAD system will feature kinetic and non-kinetic defeat capabilities, and it will provide soldiers with all-round air defence protection through a mixture of guns, missiles, rockets and onboard sensors.
This is additional protection to what can already be provided, or is it sort of a like-for-like replacement?
It's something that's new. And the US Army hopes it will be able to destroy, neutralise or deter low-altitude aerial threats such as UAVs, fixed-wing aircraft and even helicopters, as well as attacking targets on the ground. And it's interesting to note that with the renewed rise of the near-peer adversary, this is needed now more than ever, perhaps. And as you said in the intro, Richard, it's one of the big priorities outlined in the 2019 Army Modernization Strategy. So there's a very big emphasis on doing this.
How many strikers will get the upgrade then?
There will be a number of different upgrades, actually, not just IAMSHORAD. Talking about hundreds of vehicles, ultimately, will get the IAMSHORAD upgrade. And at the same time, Richard, there's also progress on the Striker Lethality Upgrade Program as well, with competition underway for the second phase of the new medium caliber weapon system turret. And that in itself, that alone, makes up 269 Striker vehicles.
What is this medium caliber weapon system program? I haven't heard much about it.
This is something that the US Army is planning to install on the double V-hulled A1 variant of Striker. And as you and listeners may know, there's a whole family of different vehicles. It would take probably too long to go through them all. But anyway, the double V-hulled A1 variant is the one that will have this medium caliber weapon system. There are two phases to this as well, Richard. Five companies have already received design integration study contracts to install their own medium caliber weapon system onto the DVH A1 platform. Now the US Army is looking to select preferred bidder or bidders for a second phase to sort of leverage their experience in developing turrets.
Yeah, it's a very versatile platform that's getting the upgrades when it needs it. Wish we could say the same for some of the UK's armoured vehicles. There we go. Never mind. Thanks, Ben. On to the air now. Tim, you've been diving into the world of loitering munitions. That's a tricky subject. You've got a story about a new release from AeroVironment. So what are we talking about here?
Yeah, that's right. So the company announced, this was the tail end of last week, the company announced that they're releasing a new variant of the Switchblade series. So this is the Switchblade 600 extended range and much larger than the other one that's previously been talked about or that's already been in the market. That's the Switchblade 300. So overall, the idea from AeroVironment is to disrupt the legacy fire and forget market. So I suppose the keys here are that loitering munitions that they're producing there's a considerable difference, not only in price, but also in collateral damage between the legacy systems. So the news is worthy on that front, that it's another step forward in that regard. But as to kind of capabilities and what it offers specifically, so it's a man-portable tube-launched system, the Switchblade 600, weighing 23 kilograms. And it's primarily produced to target light tactical vehicles and can be deployed in less than 10 minutes is the claim there from AeroVironment. And then looking at kind of speeds, 115 miles per hour, flight time more than 40 minutes, and it has a wave-off capability as well, so a strike can be stopped at a moment's notice. And then the manufacturer's also talking about some encrypted capabilities, so its ability to fly in GPS-denied environments are important. That's from the integration of the AES-256 digitally encrypted data link and secure GPS. There's the top-down overview of the capabilities, and I guess why it's so important to from a market perspective.
Yeah, I mean the market for loitering munitions is growing, isn't it? I mean they've got certain advantages over manned platforms, other unmanned platforms. It sort of combines almost the best of both worlds, or the same capabilities from an unmanned aerial platform with a strike capability that was already fitted into it. I mean, it's quite a potent package.
Yeah, and I mean, these things aren't just kind of being, you know, stockpiled or, you know, researched and tested. You know, you have Israel supplying Azerbaijan with some loitering munitions. There's been images in there of debris and wreckage. So I suppose with the Switchblade 600 from the American perspective, these are being bought or at least tested fairly rapidly. And the 600, for example, will go through or has had a year of flight testing and is expected to have IOC in 2021. But yeah, certainly from an operational perspective, you're quite right that they're very much in demand. And it's also, I think, interesting from a company perspective, because from the Take AeroVironment's example, you know, you'd probably more associate them with tactical UAVs, Raven, Wasp, Puma, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear that there's demand and the opportunity to not only produce, you know, more what we might call, you know, traditional UAVs and match that with what they would say is a gap in the market in terms of being able to offer customers something that's have an important alternative to the fire and forget missiles.
Yeah, absolutely. The march of technology just keeps on going. I don't think we can stop it, even if we try. Thanks, Tim. For all listeners, if you'd like to find out more about the stories discussed in this episode, please visit our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. You can also start a conversation or give us feedback joining the Global Defence Community Group on LinkedIn, a platform to interact with our team of journalists and analysts and discuss the news as it happens. Head over to shepherdmedia.com/globaldefencecommunity or search Global Defence Community on LinkedIn to join. Coming up next, I talk with Asia-Pacific editor Gordon Arthur about the major headlines from his region.
It's a fairly obvious point, but military equipment is getting increasingly sophisticated, and therefore the requirement to effectively train people not just to use it, but also to fight with that military equipment is becoming increasingly complex and demanding.
The biggest challenge that we have is not only designing and delivering training now for Generation Y, is planning for Generation Z, but the capabilities that we're developing now, when you look at the new Challenger tank or the new Warrior, but think of Type 31 ships, the new Dreadnought submarine, all of those, we need to start thinking about Generation Alpha.
The way we work is changing at a tremendous pace. The coronavirus pandemic has exposed the need to upskill employees whose roles were already being disrupted by the rapid evolution of emerging technologies. Welcome to the Defining the Future podcast, Shepherd Studios' series on aerospace and defence innovation, sponsored by our partner Raytheon UK, a company invested in Britain, creating British jobs and supporting local communities around the United Kingdom. Over the course of 4 episodes, we will tell the story of how innovation, fostered by industry, is helping the UK step out of the shadow of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic. We will hear how emerging technologies are supporting the prosperity agenda developed by the government to accelerate Britain's growth in these uncertain times. And we will hear from representatives across industry about how transformation and cutting-edge technologies designed for the military are beginning to reshape the commercial sector. To learn more about how defence innovation is transforming the training sphere, listen to the Defining the Future podcast, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It seems the smallest act of intrigue or mischief can provoke a reaction in the Asia-Pacific region, the latest of which saw Japan take umbrage to China's creation of a new online museum detailing Beijing's right to the Diu or Senkaku Islands, depending on one's allegiance. Maybe this is China's way of responding to Japan's intention to significantly increase its defence budget, or maybe I'm writing my own narrative. Either way, it seems a great opportunity to turn to Gordon Arthur, our Asia-Pacific editor, for his take on the fraying tensions, the big budgets and acquisitions from the past month. Gordon, welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Richard.
Given my introduction, if you can call it that, let's start with Japan and its defence budget. It's gone on the increase. What are the reasons for that, do you think?
Yeah, we should just point out that this is a budget request, so it hasn't actually been formally approved by the government yet. So this is what the Ministry of Defence is actually asking for. And this year continues an eight-year trend of a record budget request. So this particular year, the Japanese MOD would like $55 billion for the coming fiscal year. And this is an 8% increase from last year. So it's a sizable amount of money. Now, we should point out that whenever Japan raises its defense budget, China jumps up and down and accuses Japan of warmongering or having a Cold War mentality. But generally, Japanese defense budget increases well below what China does for its own PLA.
What kind of platforms are maybe driving this potential budget increase? What kind of capabilities are they looking to bring into service near term, long term?
Yeah, I mean, there's within the budget, there's some highly expensive pieces of equipment. So one of them is ballistic missile defense. And I think we've talked before about Aegis Ashore. Japan's actually turned away from that and it's now exploring alternatives. So it's concerned about missiles from North Korea and or China. So that's an area that gobbles up a lot of money. Also, it's researching and developing hypersonic missiles. So that's a new area that Japan's getting into. And another expensive area is re-equipping the Japan Air Self-Defense Force. So we're talking about F-35s. And there's also a development, the FX fighter, which is going to be a sixth-generation fighter. So that's still in the early stages. No decision has been made on a prime contractor for that. But probably we would expect Mitsubishi Heavy Industries will be the one to be the prime integrator for that project. I can just give you some timetables for the FX. So Japan is saying prototype production should start fiscal year 2024, design finalized 2027, and first flight the following year. And so this is quite a long, we're looking some distance into the future because series production wouldn't start until the 2030s and perhaps entering service in 2035. And Japan wants the FX to replace its old F2 fighters, which are based on the F-16. Now, Richard, you've probably heard quite a bit about loyal wingmen as well in recent days.
I have.
Well, you'll be intrigued to know that Japan is getting on the bandwagon as well. So it's actually going to explore loyal wingmen, and this would work perfectly with the new FX fighter when it's eventually unveiled. So we don't know too much at the moment, but indications are perhaps one FX fighter controlling three loyal wingmen, which would have sensors and also munitions on board. But there's also one other interesting aircraft in the JASDF that's worth talking about, and it just happened this past week. For the Air Self-Defense Force have introduced an RC-2 aircraft.
What's an RC-2 aircraft, Gordon?
Well, I'm sure you know what a C-2 is. That's the...
I do know C-2. The R is unusual to me.
That's right. So there's a C-2 is a Kawasaki transport aircraft. It's a jet-engined aircraft used at the moment only by Japan. So the RC-2 is a special electronic warfare version of this aircraft. Mm. So on the 1st of October, the first example was handed over to the Japan's Air Self-Defense Force. And the budget actually contained money for extra developments and extra RC-2 aircraft. So Japan has existing sort of E-Lint Comet aircraft, but they're based on older airframes. They drastically need to be replaced. And so it settled on the C-2 as the platform on which to base its new electronic warfare aircraft.
Yeah, it's interesting they've chosen to do that. It's an easier way of introducing a capability rather than developing a whole new platform. Why not use a platform you've already got? It makes perfect sense. I'm surprised why more people don't try and do that. Moving on to the Philippines. Now, we touched on the Philippines Super Tucanos arriving home in last week's podcast. I perhaps didn't fully appreciate the journey that they went through in order to get there, which was impressive. So I think it's a story that we should learn a little bit more about. So they have arrived, or they are arriving, I should say. What kind of capabilities will these aircraft bring to the Philippines?
The Philippines ordered six of them, and the first four arrived in the Philippines on 19th September. And as you say, yes, it was an arduous journey. So they left Brazil late August. They stopped over in the Canary Islands, Portugal, Malta, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, India, Bangladesh, Thailand, Vietnam, and finally the Philippines. So it did take them quite a while to get there. Unfortunately, two of them got left behind in India. Apparently, it was a paperwork issue. So they've only just arrived sort of in recent days, well behind the others. But yeah, a very important capability for the Philippine Air Force. You may remember several years ago, we had the Battle of Marawi, which is in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. And the Philippines was using helicopters and older aircraft in that particular battle. But the Super Tucanos, they bring a lot more capability, and so they'll be able to carry precision guided munitions and so on, which will be very important for any future counterinsurgency operations that the Philippine military has to participate in.
Is there any training or support that's going with this program, or is the Philippine Air Force able to operate these platforms from the get-go?
The Embraer, the Brazilian manufacturer of the aircraft, they're giving Filipino pilots 2 months training. That was part of the original contract. So, yeah, I guess as we speak, Philippine personnel are being trained, so the pilots and the maintainers, so that they'll be able to look after these aircraft on its own. And I would add to that too, I mean, the Philippines has a requirement of much more than just six sort of light attack aircraft. So it's very possible that in the future it will order extra aircraft. As always, money's the problem. So
fingers crossed. To the lovely land side of things, and confirmation that Pakistan is using the Chinese-made VT-4 main battle tank. What kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, I'd like to know that myself, Richard. I can't give you any numbers. Of course, China is very secretive about what it makes for itself and what it sells to others. But probably the order for the VT-4s was made last year. And some sources in Pakistan are quoting a number of 176 tanks, with a price tag of $859 million. So I haven't been able to verify that from official sources, so whether it's correct or not, I'm not quite sure. It's one of those deals, like people have talked about it, it's been rumoured, and it's only just recently that we've had the actual confirmation that it's all occurred. And this was shown to us on the 22nd September, and there was a mobility and live fire demonstration in Pakistan. And so we were able to see for the first time official confirmation that the Pakistan Army is now operating the VT-4.
And the VT-4 itself is it, I think it's an export version of a type that's operated by the People Liberation Army.
Yes, exactly. So it's the Type 92 is the version, or is what the PLA calls it, and the VT-4 is the export version of that. You may know that Thailand is a customer for the VT-4 and also Nigeria. And so this is Pakistan confirmed as the third customer. Interestingly, just very short time before, so the end of July, the Pakistan Army also formally inducted the Al Khalid 1 main battle tank, which is assembled in Pakistan, but actually also based on a Chinese design, but the older MBT 3000 platform. So certainly the VT-4 is a big step up for the Pakistan Army. And no doubt Pakistan was concerned about India improving its tank fleet. So it's responding in kind.
Indeed, China's influence continues to expand. Interesting.
Yep.
Finally, we've got a story, one of your stories, about the US Marine Corps changing its bases, reshuffling its operations in the Pacific. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the US, we don't normally consider as an Asia-Pacific country, but the fact is that it is one of the largest militaries in Asia-Pacific. So it has a very heavy presence in Japan. There's also a sizable force in South Korea. And Guam is actually the westernmost territory of the US. So Guam is a very important base and facility for the US military. Currently, we have Anderson Air Force Base there, and also we have Naval Base Guam. So those are two important facilities. So the big news was that the US Marines have inaugurated a new base in Guam. And this is something that stems back many years. I visited Guam probably 6-7 years ago, and I did talk to the US military about it then, and it was nothing was totally confirmed at that point. So it's been inching forward ever slowly. And this is the base being established. Not that it's going to be sort of filled with Marines from the get-go. It's going to take a number of years before it reaches its full complement of Marines, which will be around about 5,000. And these are primarily coming from Okinawa in Japan.
Okay, so that's, as we know, a locally controversial facility that the US has there. So is this I don't know, is this being drawn by political pressure? Is it financial or is this purely strategic?
Primarily it's political. So Okinawa, there's always been a lot of resistance from the local Okinawans. They don't like having the US military there. There have been occasional accidents or crimes committed, and the relations are not good. So the Japanese government have sort of tried to come up with solutions. The US Marines are actually going to, they've been handing back various areas and tracts of land. It's going to move its main air base further north in Okinawa. But a part of the agreement between Japan and the US was to actually shift these 5,000 Marines away from Okinawa and to Guam, just to ease pressure and to soothe the concerns of the local people. Interestingly, this project to relocate the US Marine units, estimated price tag, $8.6 billion. I'm sure it'll end up more than that. But the Japanese government is actually bankrolling more than $3 billion of it. So Japan's actually paying the US to move. Yeah. So some might say that's a good deal for the Americans. So a lot of the new facilities in Okinawa, in Guam, which include barracks, new facilities on the airfield, they're actually being paid for by the Japanese people, the Japanese taxpayer, if you will.
Indeed, courtesy of the Japanese taxpayer, the U.S. Marine Corps get to reshuffle and rebase elsewhere in the Asia Pacific region. Interesting.
Yeah, and you did mention too about whether it was strategic, but I think that all also does come into it because, as I mentioned, Guam is a particularly vital territory for the US. It is within missile and aircraft range of China, and is certainly very vulnerable, and the US military realizes that, so it does have plans in place to strengthen the defences there. And one of those plans is to install Aegis Ashore, perhaps by 2026. But having Marines on Guam, it reduces the footprint in Okinawa, and it also spreads the locations where the Marines are based. So that's probably a strategic advantage. They're not all, they won't all be wiped out in one fell swoop, so to speak.
Indeed. Indeed. It looks like it's a pretty decent deal for all sides. The Marines get to distribute their lethality. The Japanese government can claim a little bit of victory. The Japanese people can get maybe a little bit more peace. So a win, just about a win on all sides, I think. Interesting.
As the Chinese would say, it's win-win.
Win-win. That's all we've got time for, unfortunately. Many thanks again, Gordon. Your time, as always, much appreciated.
Thank you, Richard.
At Shepherd Media, we understand defence and aerospace audiences and how to reach them. We've been doing that for four decades, and now you can fill the gap left by cancelled trade shows with Shepherd's new Defence Audiences marketing solution. Defence Audiences aims to mitigate the lack of events by bringing innovative marketing to the forefront of the industry, allowing you to take advantage of our digital leadership to achieve your marketing goals for the year. Our Defence Audiences offering provides predefined and bespoke packages of solutions for companies looking to tell their stories and influence key defence decision makers with product launches, thought leadership, lead generation, or product education. To position your brand centrally to the defence and aerospace markets, speak to Shepherd Media about how Defence Audiences will help you today.
Al Potter was appointed last month as the Managing Director of the National Security and Defence Business for Leidos UK. Al served in the RAF for 23 years, reaching the rank of Squadron Leader, before he moved into industry, initially with Augusta Westland, later with Lockheed Martin, and later still with Boeing. Al, welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for the introduction there.
So I thought we'll dive straight in with some questions for you, given your experience and your new position. In terms of the defence sector, Leidos is one of the 19 strategic suppliers to the MOD, I believe. So can you encapsulate, given this status, can you encapsulate what Leidos's main specialisms are?
I can, actually. And that was the reason why I was attracted to joining Leidos. So Leidos really is an integrator of integrators, or a system of system integrator. It's got sort of eight broad capabilities, started really with enterprise IT modernization, cyber operations, operations and logistics, which I think people tend to only know us for, mission software, integration of other systems into larger systems, hence the overall title. But it also does sensors into larger systems and then support some of the missions as well that are around the world. And when you look at the UK, it's got small elements of each of those. It's a sort of smaller version of the larger Leidos in the US.
So there's no single specialism that Leidos is concentrating on within the UK?
I think people know us for LCST and tend to think as a logistics company. But actually, if you were in the home office, you would think of us as providing home office biometrics. And where there, that's very much around, you know, move to the cloud, application development, software development, and of course, protecting it all with a cyber operations.
And if we just take a snapshot of Leidos's operations today in the UK, if you could... Maybe you could just give us a quick summary of the main programs that Leidos is working on.
Sure. So I think, first of all, it splits into three. So we have three effective. We do have the LCST contract, which was the
Logistic Commodities and Services Transformation.
That's the one. You said it better than I did. So you get used to saying LCST all the time and you forget the actual, what the acronym means. But so that's a big piece of the business on its own. And it tends to be what people tend to think of us as. But actually, if you look around into, first of all, national security and defence, then we've got, in the Home Office, we're doing biometrics. We're doing a lot with Border Force on Border Crossing, which links into HMRC. We're doing a lot in MOD, some in specialist areas that I probably won't particularly talk about, but others around, you know, the manipulation, the movement and of data and the interpretation of that data. So it kind of falls into that kind of category. And I think there's quite a span of things that we do, and I probably missed a couple. But if you think, you know, that's quite a broad portfolio for a business that's really about 1,100 people. 1,000 to 1,100 people wide.
And of course, speaking in terms of national security and defence, you mentioned the LCST, and also the work that you're doing in data interpretation and data manipulation. Obviously, as you said, there are certain programs you can't talk about for security reasons, but can you just sort of give us a flavour of how you are, a company like yours, which is working at the very high end, how you're actually working in terms of sort of data manipulation and data interpretation in your programs?
I think the first thing is we've invested in the people that are exactly doing the job, because so you end up with an ecosystem or an environment that you're manipulating that data in. You then, first of all, you protect that environment, you move it, you store it in perhaps a different manner to others, or you've done it first, or you might be doing it in a multi-domain security domain way. So you're putting the data into the right places for the right people to access. And then you've got staff who are making sure that, you know, we are applying the latest tools in AI, machine learning, and we've got some visions around what a new analyst for the future might look like. And so, you know, we're starting to develop those type of things. And then actually we're going back to those people who are doing those programs and going, give us your really good ideas and let's start innovating those and bringing those forward. So one of the things we've just launched is an innovation hub, which is bringing some of the, you know, ground floor ideas up into sort of visibility of the senior leadership team. And then we're investing in some of them. And so that you start to get this sort of cycle of you know, on contract and out of contract growth from that innovation.
I can see it's sort of a virtuous spiral of innovation and profitability, yeah. I suppose, as a company. That's the bottom line for you.
You would hope.
Can I ask you about the engagement that Leidos has with SMEs in the defence sector?
Yeah.
Obviously, there are, particularly if you're talking about the LCST program, that's a massive program, 6.7 billion, I believe. At least that's one of the figures that I saw quoted. And obviously, you can't do it on your own. You need a team around you of other organisations. So what's the sort of philosophy behind how Leidos is engaging with the defence SMEs?
So if you think about the three divisions, I run the National Security and Defence one, and so Damien Alexander runs the LCST division, but it's kind of the same philosophy across the business, really. He's got a slightly different constraint because he is dealing with people that the MOD may well have already selected. There are certain things that he can go to market for, so they use Leidos tools and techniques to run, you know, supply chain competitions, etc. But I think that's a relatively smaller part than the actual main bulk of it. That tends to be from a lot of his, predefined by the MOD that, you know, this is, we want you to go and buy this, please, from these suppliers. Now, in the rest of us, yeah, in the other areas, we've got more of a free rein, I think, and that there you can see actually quite a large SME community starting to develop, especially in the NSND space. One of the things that we decided in one of our bids is actually being a safe umbrella for SMEs so that they can get access to certain frameworks, etc., might well give us a competitive advantage as well. Because, you know, we like to think we're quite agile. We know SMEs are agile. And so if you put the two together, can you have the security of a larger company, but pulling SMEs through and protecting their IP? One of the things that we're very clear about, and if you look Leidos up, I did when I did my due diligence on it before I joined, there aren't many defence companies in the top 50 ethical companies. Well, Leidos is. And so part of that is how you treat not only your employees, but how you treat your suppliers and also how you treat your customers. And so that attracted me, and I can see that in our culture and how we deal with companies. That, I think, is a competitive advantage for companies that grasp that, you know, SME community.
I see you mentioned agility,
yeah.
Very much as a key word. Agility from yourselves, agility from your supply chain. But this might be a rather tricky question. Doesn't the customer as well need to be relatively agile in order to take advantage of everything that you and your supply chain can offer?
Well, that is a really good point. And so you can see the customer trying to do that. You know, it can't be agile when it's going to go and buy something at 6 billion. You know, it's got a process to go through. However, it's going to buy something for £200. It can be pretty agile. And so it's a sliding scale of agility based on what they're going to go get. And that's how they used to think of it. But I think also it's about the technology that they're going to get. You know, most, you know, you go and buy something, you know, in the IT domain, it's probably out of date a year later. If you buy an iPhone, it's going to get, you know, it's going to get replaced within 6 months, 8 months, something like that. And you know that if you need the latest cutting edge piece, you've got to do that quite quickly. So there are certain things that you've got to be agile about. There are certain things that you've got to take your time and you've got to, you know, cover a really robust process. And you see the customer doing, you know, rapid capability offices, you know, the J-Hub, things like that, where it's trying to get that, you know, rapid insertion of technology that can be used, fail fast, dumped, or used success and adopted. And so, yeah, we absolutely applaud that.
I suppose it's an unfortunate fact that, in a way, that technology evolves and adapts so quickly and rapidly, it must be inherently difficult for the customer or indeed businesses such as Leidos to stay abreast of the latest developments as they apply to the defence sector.
Well, I think that's where our advantage is, because we don't make those products. And so we can literally shift every 6 to 8 months to some other product that does the same thing for a cheaper price or for a better effect, you know, because we're agnostic to it. What we've then done to bring our own agility, you know, our own procedures and processes, is we've adopted some of the techniques that have been pioneered in the US around. There's a thing called Kessel Run in the US, which was how do you do software really quickly?
That's a Star Wars reference, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. And so the US Air Force did this. And so, you know, we adopted in the US this same thing. So we built these software factories based on the same way of doing it. Guess what? We've just invested in one in the UK. It's going to open in Farnborough, I think January. And we've already got customers that are going to use that, of how you rapidly develop software for particular applications and roll it in very quickly. And that's multi-domain. And some of it is some of the tasks that are going in there, they're not simple tasks. These are really quite tricky problems to go solve.
That's such a good idea to have that kind of the factory that you mentioned in opening in, yep, Farnborough, which kind of raises a question, the rather annoying question, perhaps. Why didn't you think of it before?
good question. I think you, as a business, you have to have the right environment with the right people. We've got a great CTO who's got, you know, some really good vision of what needed to be done. He's been championing this since last year. We had a time and a place with, you know, two new customers coming on board who had liked the idea and adopted it. And so, you know, the stars aligned and boom, there we go. So we invested in it and away we're going. The building work's just about finished. We're just about to start, COVID permitting. At the moment, it's being done virtually. So effectively, it's delivering, but as a physical entity, it will be available from the first.
Okay, well, that opens in January, you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Should do. Fingers crossed if we're allowed to.
Let's hope so. So as MD, you've been in place for a few weeks now. Still fairly new, of course. But in terms of where you're aiming to lead the UK business, can you give a kind of an overview of what your strategy is?
Indeed. So it's got several elements to it, but the real theme of it is around the pivot I think we will see out of ISDSR. First of all, the customer is talking ISDSR. So they're not talking defence, they're not talking security, they're talking integrated security defence review. Every customer we go talk to talks about either information advantage, digital transformation to give an information advantage, or some other set and form of words that effectively mean the same across the same all domains. So our focus and our strategy is to deliver an information advantage for our customers. How we do that is go back to our core capabilities. Which ones do we need to grow? Which ones do we need to perhaps back off from? Where do we need to refocus? And then look at where we currently are situated and grow out from those. What I'm calling our lily pads. Grow out from our lily pads. So take our customers from our known delivery to our unknown, as opposed to just dropping into new markets and trying to convince people to buy from us. And then as that gets bigger and bigger, which I'm sure it will, then joining the dots for our customers, which effectively is fusion doctrine that they published some time ago.
I see. Now, a lot of organisations and companies, not just Leidos, I expect, are seeking to deliver that kind of information advantage to the military. How are you going to try and differentiate yourselves? Is it by sort of placing an accent more on artificial intelligence, perhaps, or machine learning?
So I think it's a number of things. I think it is what the US would call refer to as the secret sauce that Leidos brings. Yeah, just how we go about things. I think it will be the tools, the processes, the supply base, the SMEs, the access to the ability to change technology as you go through a contract, the ability to bring really quite clever people to bear. We've got some really good employees who do some really clever stuff, and just bringing them to bear on some knotty problems from the customer allows the customer to gain that advantage. And so I think it's a combination of all those, which eventually gives you your culture and identity linked with our values and our ethics. And I think you just get a slightly different approach.
And at the moment, we, of course, as you've already mentioned, we're living in a landscape of rapidly changing technology, and new capabilities are emerging all the time that militaries and other security agencies are deeply interested in. One of those is, of course, unmanned systems, which we're all well aware of, and no doubt the listeners are as well. But in terms of Leidos in particular, you're probably aware of the work Leidos in the States has been doing on with the US Navy on robotic naval vessels.
Yeah, indeed.
Is that correlation or transfer of that experience that you can bring to bear for the Royal Navy, do you think?
So I think would I attempt to bring one of those ships over and sell to the Royal Navy? No. But what I would do is bring the thinking and some of the subsystems, perhaps, and some of the how you manage the data flow, how you manage the operations of those types of vessels, because that's where I'm focused in the UK, as opposed to trying to go and sell them a ship that they might or might not want. It'll be more about how do you bring your unmanned vehicles into your digital ecosystem if I was going to go talk to them about it, and how do you then plan that into your fleet? How do you make that sustainable? How do you make it, what's the footprint that you, because most unmanned vehicles require a human footprint at some point. Some of them require more human footprint than when you are operating them as a manned vehicle. So what does that do? So it's more about the thinking around it, more around the ecosystem that we would bring and bring that expertise over, I would suspect.
And unmanned systems, no doubt, will feature in the ISDSR that's coming up. And you referred to that shortly earlier, Al. But we hear a lot about the needs of the various service chiefs in relation to future sort of defence procurement and future defence equipment needs. But speaking as somebody who's involved in industry, what do you think industry needs to see from this very, very important security review in the UK?
I think we need some certainty. We always say that. We rarely get it because, you know, the service chiefs live in a very changing world, and they've got to, you know, not only deal with the now, but they've got to deal with the 10 year from now. Go back to my point about, you know, I buy an iPhone in 6 months' time. You know, one, I don't know what the iPhone I'm getting today does. In 6 months' time, it's a quantum change. And in 2 years' time, it is a phenomenally different capability. So they are in an ever-changing threat cycle. They're in almost a Moore's Law approach to what your adversary can do. So they've got a really big challenge. Industry wants a certainty. And I think what we'll get is a theme. And as long as we can see what the themes of where they're going and where they're going to spend money, we can invest to match the themes of where they're going to go and spend money. The problem you get is when industry thinks, I've just invented the ballpoint pen and everybody's moved to iPads and nobody wants to buy a ballpoint pen anymore. And you know, you've got to change that ballpoint pen into an iPad pencil or an Android pencil. So industry needs to know what the theme is so that you can adapt either your current product set to meet it or your services or your thinking around where you're going to position yourself in the market.
Thank you very much, Al.
Cheers. Thanks, Ben.
You've been listening to another episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast. As always, a big thanks to everyone who took the time in being with us today. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the show, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. Shepherd Media is also offering a 20% discount for annual subscription to Premium News. Head over to shepherdmedia.com/subscribe and insert code podcast20 to redeem, which is valid until the 31st of December 2020. Until next week, thanks for listening.